Okay, well, it's with mixed emotions that I introduce this panel. I'm slightly saddened that what for me at least has been a very exciting day and a half is coming to an end, but I'm very pleased that we have a fantastic group of people here for our panel on arts and culture, and I think we're going to end on a very high note. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce once again the panel's moderator, Daily Planet co-host, and I'm going to pronounce her name right this time, and I apologize for the first time, Zaya Tong. How was that?
Yeah, you got it.
Okay.
Can you guys hear me okay? Is this working all right?
Okay, wonderful. Well, I'm really, really thrilled to be here today because I honestly still have nightmares sometimes that I didn't ever graduate from McGill University at all. So it's great to be here, especially to be invited by Will Straw because he was the head of my department, the GPC, Graduate Program in Communications. And I love this city. And so I'm also so happy to be here to introduce our very esteemed and established panel. Everybody here is truly a Canadian star and success story. So I'm going to start. Just to my right here is Patrick Watson. I think many of you guys know who Patrick is. He's a Montreal musician, and his album Close to Paradise won the Polaris Music Prize in 2007. And his latest album is the hit record Adventures in Your Own Backyard. Welcome, Patrick!
Hello.
Next to Patrick is Deborah Chow, and she is a Canadian filmmaker. I've actually seen her film. It's called The High Cost of Living. It's exceptional. It starred Zach Braff and Isabelle Blais, and the movie was named Best Canadian First Feature at TIFF, which was amazing. And it was also the Best Canadian Film at the Female Eye Film Festival as well. Welcome, Deborah. Okay, Tantu Cardinal is another very familiar Canadian face. She's an Aboriginal actress whose credits include Black Robe, North of 60, and Dances with Wolves, which I loved. Tantu is also a companion of the Order of Canada, and she is a role model who inspires youth. Welcome. And, of course, at the very end there is Jack Rabinovich, who is just a wonderful human being and a very well-known arts patron and Canadian philanthropist. He's the founder of the Giller Book Prize, which is named after his late wife, Doris Giller, who was a former literary columnist for the Toronto Star. Jack is a member of the Order of Canada, which means he has that little pin, and the Order of Ontario. Two pins! Nicely done. Great. Okay, so we're really here today to talk a little bit about Canadian success and what that means. So I think really because we have such a diverse panel here today from, we've got literature, we've got actresses, we've got filmmakers and musicians, I would like for each one of you, starting with you actually, Patrick, to really talk about what success means. And that's because these days, you know, in the past it was like maybe you could afford to buy a house, maybe success meant you had some money, maybe it meant fame. These days it seems like it means likes or how many followers you have. So what is success?
I guess, well, I'm going to speak in music terms, I guess, because I play music. It's funny, when I did this panel, as I was looking, I was like, well, that's a tough question. I think my definition of success has changed so much since I was a kid. You know, in music, I think a lot of people in music have like this dream of being a bit kind of famous and kind of big, you know, the idealistic kind of thing with music, and it went through so many transitions. I guess now what I consider like a success is a certain freedom. So building a career that I have a freedom to do whatever I want in the ways I like to do it. And I think in music, it's a very hard task, you know, because it's not an easy world in music because there's lots of rules and how things work. So I guess for me, the last 10 years, I really spent building something that I could do orchestral shows. I play with the orchestra sometimes. I do movie scores, I do albums, I do touring, so I do all these different things. So I guess for me, success was just achieving a place where I had the freedom to do all these different things in music. So for me, that's what I guess I wanted as success. But I don't think I could have ever made like a hit number one song. Like I don't think I'd be good at that. I think I still play around the world, and I'm very fortunate to play in almost all the continents around the world and tour anywhere I want and play for people. So I guess for me that. It's mostly about a freedom than anything else. So that's how I see success.
Well, you just got back from playing in the woods, right?
Hiding in the woods is different than playing in the woods.
Absolutely. Okay, how about you, Deborah?
I think at this point, I would say, you know, success for me, it's just actually making a living, getting to do what I want to do. You know, in creative careers, I think it's so hard just to actually make a living doing what you love. So I think I just feel fortunate at this point that I'm not just wanting to be a director, but actually I'm a writer and director, and I can make a living that way. In terms of professional success, I don't know. I feel like a lot of it has to do with perspective, in terms of how you're perceived and what success. You know, I guess in Canada at this point in film, you know, it might be considered a modest success or somewhat, you know, just sort of starting out. But, you know, in the States, it's still like, who are you? So, you know, it sort of depends where you are, too.
And then, Tanti, for you, how about, you've been doing this for such a long period of time and you're deemed successful, you know, really amongst a huge group of people within your own community as well as the nation. So what does success mean to you?
Well, that varies from day to day. But today I'm thinking that success is, has been finding people of common vision who, despite so many obstructions, when we were asked initially to come and bring an object or bring something that signified something about your career, I wanted to bring the Indian Act because it is so debilitating, and like those boundaries on reservations, keeping everything in some kind of a container. And so for me to be able to go anywhere, coming from the world that needed a pass to leave the reservation, can you imagine? To be able to leave Montreal, you'd have to get a piece of paper from the government to allow you to get on the bus to go to Toronto or something like that.
Right.
I mean, it is just, it's an insane world that we come from when you talk about Canadian culture. Well, my idea of culture is very different from, everybody's got their own idea of what Canadian culture is. So it's finding people who can see you outside of those boundaries, and you have a common vision of humanity.
Right, very true. Now, Jack, I have two questions for you. You've had such a long and successful career in many different fields, so if you could kind of speak to us about what success is, but also I'm kind of wondering, if you just do one thing in your life, can you be considered successful? Because you've done many things, but you founded the Giller Prize. So let's say if somebody writes one book, and can they kind of rest on that? Like, can you be considered successful if you only ever do one successful thing in your life?
I would think so. I would think that the previous panel sort of hit on it. During a lifetime, many doors open, and success means going through the door and taking a chance. You don't know what's on the other side. You know that you have a certain amount of self-confidence and you think you can do it. But just going through the open door and taking a chance, that's whether you fail or not, or whether you succeed or not, I don't think that's the important thing. The important thing is that you've gone through a door that is open for you. You've taken the chance. And I think that's true whether you're Canadian or non-Canadian.
Right. How about you, Patrick? I'm wondering, you know, you're in the field of music, so what about the notion of the one-hit wonder?
It's not really what I wanted. I kind of, I'm so bored after I wrote the song. What do I do now? You know? But my dream was always to have a career that kept on evolving and changing. And I kind of really hoped that I would write my best things as I got older. That would be what I ideally wanted to build. So
yeah.
Whether that happens or not, I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's very true to have something to savor. It's a lot like for me when people ask me how many different countries I've been to, and I really don't want to go to all the different countries in the world. I want to save different places to explore later on. And, pardon?
I think it's a lot harder. Whoops, sorry.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot harder to build a career that you have constant different things, and it takes a lot of effort in terms of keeping your creativity healthy. And it kind of sounds like a cheesy thing to say, but really it's a... something really important that you actually have to touch yourself every day just to keep the muscle alive. So it's I find it definitely gets more and more difficult as you have said more and more things to find more things to say.
Right. So. And I guess the next question for me too, and this is where we'll just do one more sweep across as we talk about this, but one thing that I'm constantly fascinated by is really failure. And I was actually listening to the person from the Stars who was on Q who was talking about what it means to be a loser in today's society, because I really think that being a failure and being a loser is truly the great equalizer when we talk about success. And I'm just on TV, but I know that when I had this dream of doing this thing and I wanted to be like David Attenborough, and I remember lying spread eagle face down on the floor and crying for half an hour in my friend's apartment and thinking, you know, I was never going to be able to do this because it seemed so impossible. And at first, every great achievement is impossible. So I was wondering if you could talk to us about those moments where perhaps you thought your dream was just way the hell too big, and then how you actually reconciled that and decided you were going to move forward anyway. Deb.
With the film business, I'd say starting off, everything with films is sort of, you have to be a little bit crazy to even be in the profession. Sinking millions of dollars into a feature film, you have no idea how it's going to do and nobody can predict. So I think to start off, it's just sort of you're taking this gigantic leap of faith, and you're either going to kind of follow that or you're not, or you should, you know, go to med school, I guess. But with failure, I mean, you know, for me, it's been 98% of the time hearing no, you know, so it's actually when you actually get somebody saying yes, that's the rare occasion. So it's just no. It's just sort of part of the journey. But I would say that, you know, some of the times, when I have failed or I've, you know, been like, oh my God, my life is over, this is never going to happen. Like, for instance, I can, you know, when I first graduated from McGill, I didn't, you know, I knew I wanted to go into film school, but I didn't know where, and I loved Montreal, I wanted to stay here, and so it was either like, okay, whatever. So I applied to Concordia, and I applied to two schools in New York. I got rejected from Concordia, and I got into Columbia, which was actually a much more aggressive and competitive program. So I ended up in New York, and that failure of not even being able to get into a film school in Canada completely changed the course of what happened to me, and honestly, it was, I think, for the best. So I think a lot of the times the things you think are failures actually turn out to be for a reason, and your career gets shaped by them.
So when you say that you had many no's, how many no's do you mean? Just as an aside, when I started out and I tried to get into this business because I had no agent and I had no background in TV, what I did have was I actually learned, I sold encyclopedias door to door in northern BC, so every day 500 doors would slam in my face. So I wrote to 2,000 television executives, of which one replied, pretty much.
Mine wasn't quite as literal. Yeah, I didn't quite have the literal door slam like that. But yeah. For instance, like when I was trying to get the film made, it took years for me to even get a producer. I couldn't, you know, I had been in film school in the States, in New York, and I came back and I really wanted to do a film in Montreal. I couldn't even get anybody to even meet me. Like, I'm just going through the list of producers and literally wouldn't even consider it. So just even getting a meeting with a producer, let alone getting a producer, took 2 years. So,
and how about you, Jack? Can you talk to us about your big spectacular failure in life?
No. No, but I should point out that within the business world, I have yet to meet an outstanding successful business person who hasn't failed at one part of his life, because failure is just part of learning, of a learning process. And if you failed, it means you've tried something that hasn't succeeded. But you've tried, and that's the important thing. And the number of wealthy or successful people who are considered highly successful are legion, but if you check anyone's background, I'm sure you'll find early failures of one sort or another.
Right. And then, Patrick, you and I had a brief chance to chat before we got here, and one thing that we kind of both talked about a little bit was the role of luck. A lot of people think that you have to have this lucky break. So what's your idea of, you know, whether or not you have to be good to be lucky, or whether or not this is all fated in the stars?
I guess in the dream job world, I think luck is something you can't control. Luck. I mean, obviously, some people get lucky and some people don't. I think you have to kind of focus on the things you can control. And I think you can put yourself in a circumstance where you'll be more lucky. I think, and you're in the dream job world, like when you're, I guess, film or music, where like there's millions of people want to do it. And it's going to definitely take a combination of skill and luck and all sorts of things to make it work. I think you have to really learn how to, like, put yourself in a place where you can get lucky. Like you said, okay, I wrote to 2,000 execs and one person answered. And it's like making your own luck. You have to put yourself in a place where, you know, it's possible it can happen. You know, like, I remember, like, 2 years ago, there's Where the Wild Things Are film.
Right.
And I wanted to score it. Like, I was like, oh, I've got to score this film. So I basically wrote a score for Spike and just sent it to him. And I never got back to him, but all the execs around, and Warner Brothers were like, oh, I love the score. He already has his personal scores it, but you can use, we'll use your song in this and that and this and that. So I think you just got to put stuff out there, and if you're not going to get what you want, you're going to get something else. I mean, everything I've gotten is not what I wanted, and then turned out to be better. So pretty much everything in my career. I mean, I never wanted to be a singer-songwriter. It's the last thing on my list.
Well, what did you want to be?
I wanted to do composition for orchestra and film score, and realized that I could never withstand the classical world or start from the movie, start from nothing. So when I started my project, I said, well, this girl out of Target Books, she's like, would you do the music for the images? I was like, okay, sure. And then I started doing songs to make it work, just to make it work together. And it worked, so I was like, oh, let's do some shows. And then it turned to be this band career that I never wanted. But I love it. It's not about that. But now I get to do the things I wanted. So I knew that I could play as an orchestra. I'm sure there's probably 100,000 people who go to music school to write for an orchestra who never get to hear the music played by an orchestra.
Right.
So I kind of went the very long, strange route around. And they're like, you could do whatever you want. I'm like, really? It's cool? Yeah. I think that it's kind of funny. Like, you just kind of have to roll with the punches, and you're never going to get what you want. You're going to get some other new version of it, and I think you have to really learn how to take that as luck and use it to your advantage. So I think that's really important.
So Tenshu, I'm also wondering too, in the creative world, in the world of arts, there tends to be this idea of really fetishizing outsiders and making them exotic. So has that sort of been an advantage for you or a disadvantage for you in your career?
I'm sorry, what was the first part of that?
The notion of just fetishizing exoticness or difference, especially in the United States, it seems like if you're considered different, because they're always plumbing for, new talent and something that stands out and something that's different, did it help you in that way? Because you've worked for American productions as well.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I was ready to answer your question about failure.
Oh, okay, sure. You can totally answer that if you prefer.
And you skipped right over me. I thought, well, what the hell's going on here? But that whole idea, when I first got involved in this business and was able to accept that there might be something for me in the arts, that telling stories would be able to change the dynamic, that finally we'd be able to retell stories that had not been told properly from a very side perspective that was not history written by ourselves. And so I was very, had all kinds of hopeful possibilities of stories that could be told, and then find out that really I'm just a color for the people who are running the camera, the people who are writing the stories, people who are putting it on the screen, and people who are putting the money in. They're not my people. But I'm colorful, so we'll put you in here and there. So I reached a place of great despondency and figured, you know what? Just give it up. Give it up. Because you can't do all the things that you want to do. And you're a laughingstock in my own mind because I couldn't do any comedy. I could not tell the main storyline, any of that kind of thing. I could not change any dynamic. I just had to be so satisfied with so little and really consider not having anything to do with this business anymore. And this woman comes over to me. Tantu Cardinal! She just grabbed me and threw her arms around me and was so excited and so grateful for what little work that I had done. I had done some television stuff, I had done some films, I don't know exactly where in my career, but it was in a moment of I'm nothing, I'm no good for nothing, why'd I even bother? And she pulled out these pictures of her two daughters from her wallet. One was a 10-year-old and one was an 8-year-old. The 10-year-old wanted to be a journalist. She wanted to be on TV like Tantu. And her little girl, her 8-year-old girl, wanted to be an actress like Tantu. And she said, because you're doing what you're doing, I just tell my girls, go ahead, my girl.
Oh, that's lovely.
It was like, you have no idea what doors, windows, what lint you're tearing off of people's minds. just by being there.
That's great.
So now, Deborah, what were you asked? What did you
ask? No, that was great. That was lovely. I guess another question that I have, too, is at what point, Deb, we'll start with you here, is like, I think in order to be a creative and to want to stand out in a sense, you have to at some point make a decision that you have a point of view that's worth sharing. So how did you decide? Did you have some defining moment in your life where you were like, you know, I have something I need to say and I need to be defiant, or do you need to be defiant in order to say that?
I guess, okay, in film, you know, that would be sort of like, when did you figure out you had a vision or you had a voice, you know, you had something to say. So this is going to be a very pro-McGill story. basically, there wasn't some overnight aha moment of going, oh, yes, I have so much to give the world and here's my original voice. It was more sort of a longer process of developing that and sort of slowly gaining confidence on that. But the original moment for me was, like, I was in my fourth year at McGill and I was in the cultural theory program. And I was taking a course, I can't remember, I think it was an alternative media or something like that. And it was also at the same time when digital media and Apple started to come out. So all of a sudden, making films, it was just, you know, we could actually do it. And you didn't need a Steinbeck, like it was the beginning of the digital revolution for film. And so everybody in my year started making, like all my social peers were making little films, and I made a film actually at McGill. And it's weird, I think, when you're developing a voice or you're trying to figure out what you want to do, is that even from the very first little film that I did at McGill for that class, I look back at it now and it's still got, like, you know, 10 things that I still have in common. You're kind of saying the same thing over and over, and that
right,
becomes sort of
like
your voice. So I think it's just, at some point you make a decision that this is what I'm going to do, and then you're just, it's sort of an extension of yourself that you're trying to find.
Right. So then another thing that I've been wondering about, too, is really ladders to success, and we've been having these conversations at Discovery. Let's say if you come and join us at Daily Planet, can you start off as a researcher, and do you know how to become a producer or what have you? So in each of your fields, which are so remarkably varied, is there a ladder to success? And like, I think Jack, I'd like to start with you because I don't know how you become a patron of the arts. Like, what's the 101 on that? How do you become you?
Well, it's one door closed and another door opened. It was really as simple as that. My late wife Doris passed away. And 6 months later, I found myself in a bar with my friend Mordecai Richler, Grumpy's, I think it was, on Bishop Street. And we decided to start a literary prize. And because we both sort of came from the same area, and we'd known each other in high school, we'd known each other for the most of our lives, we decided to start a literary prize named the Giller Prize. And it was very strange because I think Mordecai had about 6 McCallums before I even finished one. But we decided to do something a little different. Mordecai made a point of it. He said, Jack, I want you to know that writers make a living by selling their books. So whatever the prize is, you have to work the prize so that it helps sell books. And so in Toronto, a year later, we threw a party, highlighted the 5 shortlisted books, and we had a panel of Mordecai Richler, David Staines, and Alice Munro. And it was an open type of party. The press were invited, and there was a free bar. So that helped the situation immensely. And all we did was invite people who were interested in books. And we sort of stole a page from the Oscars, and we had vignettes of each of the books, so that the people who were there could get a little more insight into the books if they hadn't read them. We encouraged wagering, which was a terrible type of thing to do, sinful, I guess, in Toronto. And so that's what happened. We started something by accident, you might say, and it just worked out. And it 20 years later, this is the 20th year, it's still working, and that's all she wrote.
That's amazing. That's incredible. So, Deb, how about for you then? Is there a clear path to becoming a director? If somebody wants to somebody who's sitting here perhaps wants to become a film director, feature film director in LA, how do you go about doing that?
Well, if you listen to the last panel, I don't know what happened here. If you listen to the last panel, you find that 2 of the outstanding people in films were there by accident. One started as a doctor, the other started as a rock musician. I keep saying the doors open, doors close. If you're not afraid to walk through the door when it's open, success may await you.
Right, right. Well, then how about the whole idea of these ladders? Like, do they even matter? Do you need to have a ladder to success if you want to be an original person, Patrick? What do you think of that? Like, do you need to have the map all charted out for you? Do you think it's helpful? Because I think sometimes it's helpful, but...
I mean, it's hard to say now. I mean, once again, I'm in music, right? So the ladder's completely gone now.
Yeah, there is no ladder. That's what I mean.
The structure's completely been... I mean, there used to be a ladder up until, like, 4 or 5 years ago. Now the ladder is completely abolished. Like, even the people on top don't even know what to do. Like,
right.
So I do you need a ladder? I think you need your own personal ladder. I think thinking about somebody else's ladder doesn't really interest me, but I think having your own kind of personal ladder is very important. And that could be... But I think a lot of people make the mistake in music or anything is they want to make some big song.
Right.
And they get focused on big ideas and they're going to make this big thing and I'm going to be big. And they forget about all the, like, the little tiny little weeny steps. And I guess for me, the ladder you talk about in music is all the little teeny weeny little steps. So, you know, like if I put out a record, it's not like I work a year and make a record and mix it, blah, blah, blah. But then I go tour it for a year. All these little details make it work. And it's all these little steps. So I'm going to go with. So I think. When it comes to music or big dreams, I think you have to make ladders of little tiny steps that you know you can succeed and just slowly climb up this. You're like, oh, Jesus. It's like, it takes a long time, and then, you know, you get to the top, and then you fall down.
But then how about you, Deb, because I know that you've sort of taken advantage of different organizations that have grants, mentorships, things like that. What's that role been for you? Because people have actually put out rungs for you to step on. Has that made a difference?
Yeah, I mean, I think film's probably eventually going to go the same way as music, but right now there's still sort of a ladder there. I probably did it the most traditionally you could. I mean, if there is a path, I mean, there's a million paths how people get there, I think, in film. But So I went to graduate school and did film school, made some shorts, did the festival circuit, then started working, you know, on a feature, agent, manager, all that stuff. So I've done it sort of, you know, fairly traditionally. But in Canada, at least, you know, telefilm... the Toronto Film Festival are huge in terms of helping young filmmakers. You know, with the Toronto Film Festival alone, you know, I started there, I had a short there, then I did their talent lab, then I had a feature there, and now I'm starting to become a mentor and I'm jurying. So, you know, there's organizations like that, I think, that do sort of help with that, but it's very much, I think, the same as, you know, what Patrick was saying, is that it's inch by inch.
But what do you do? I mean, do you literally knock on the door? Do you call Cameron Bailey? Like, how do you get into TIFF? Like, how does that happen?
You pray.
Okay, well, it's with mixed emotions that I introduce this panel. I'm slightly saddened that what, for me at least, has been a very exciting day and a half is coming to an end, but I'm very pleased that we have a fantastic group of people here for our panel on arts and culture, and I think we're going to end on a very high note. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce, once again, the panel's moderator, Daily Planet co-host, and I'm going to pronounce her name right this time, and I apologize for the first time, Zaya Tong. How was that?
Yeah, you got it.
Okay.
Got it.
Can you guys hear me okay? Is this working all right?
Okay, wonderful.
Well, I'm really, really thrilled to be here today because I honestly still have nightmares sometimes that I didn't ever graduate from McGill University at all. So it's great to be here, especially to be invited by Will Straw because he was the head of my department, the GPC, Graduate Program in Communications, and I love this city. And so I'm also so happy to be here to introduce our very esteemed and established panel. Everybody here is truly a Canadian star and success story. So I'm going to start. Just to my right here is Patrick Watson. I think many of you guys know who Patrick is. He's a Montreal musician, and his album Close to Paradise won the Polaris Music Prize in 2007. And his latest album is the hit record, Adventures in Your Own Backyard. Welcome, Patrick!
Hello.
Next to Patrick is Deborah Chow, and she is a Canadian filmmaker. I've actually seen her film. It's called The High Cost of Living. It's exceptional. It starred Zach Braff and Isabelle Blais, and the movie was named Best Canadian First Feature at TIFF, which was amazing. And it was also the Best Canadian Film at the Female Eye Film Festival as well. Welcome, Deborah. Okay, Tantu Cardinal is another very familiar Canadian face. She's an Aboriginal actress whose credits include Black Robe, North of 60, and Dances with Wolves, which I loved. Tentu is also a companion of the Order of Canada, and she is a role model who inspires youth. Welcome. And, of course, at the very end there is Jack Rabinovich, who is just a wonderful human being and a very well-known arts patron and Canadian philanthropist. He's the founder of the Giller Book Prize, which is named after his late wife, Doris Giller, who was a former literary columnist for the Toronto Star. Jack is a member of the Order of Canada, which means he has that little pin, and the Order of Ontario, two pins. Nicely done. Great. Okay, so we're really here today to talk a little bit about Canadian success and what that means. So I think really because we have such a diverse panel here today from, we've got literature, we've got actresses, we've got filmmakers and musicians. I would like for each one of you, starting with you actually, Patrick, to really talk about what success means. And that's because these days, you know, in the past it was like maybe you could afford to buy a house, maybe success meant you had some money, maybe it meant fame. These days it seems like it means likes or how many followers you have. So what is success?
I guess, well, I'm going to speak in music terms, I guess, because I play music. It's funny, when I did this panel, as I was looking, I was like, well, that's a tough question. I think my definition of success has changed so much since I was a kid. You know, in music, I think a lot of people in music have like this dream of being a bit kind of famous and kind of this big, you know, the idealistic kind of thing with music. And it went through so many transitions. I guess now what I consider like a success is a certain freedom. So building a career that I have a freedom to do whatever I want in the ways I like to do it. And I think in music, it's a very hard task, you know, because it's not an easy world in music because there's lots of rules and how things work. So I guess for me, the last 10 years, I really spent building something that I could do orchestral shows. I play with the orchestra sometimes. I do movie scores, I do albums, I do touring. So I do all these different things. So I guess for me, success was just achieving a place where I had the freedom to do all these different things in music. So for me, that's what I guess I wanted as success. But I don't think I could have ever made like a hit number one song. Like I don't think I'd be good at that. I think I still play around the world, and I'm very fortunate to play in almost all the continents around the world and tour anywhere I want and play for people. So I guess for me, that it's mostly about a freedom than anything else. So that's how I see success.
Well, you just got back from playing in the woods, right?
Hiding in the woods is different than playing in the woods.
Absolutely. Okay, how about you, Deborah?
I think at this point, I would say, you know, success for me, it's just actually making a living, getting to do what I want to do. You know, in creative careers, I think it's so hard just to actually make a living doing what you love. So I think I just feel fortunate at this point that I'm not just wanting to be a director, but actually I'm a writer and director, and I can make a living that way. In terms of professional success, I don't know. I feel like a lot of it has to do with perspective, in terms of how you're perceived and what success. You know, I guess in Canada at this point in film, you know, I might be considered a modest success or somewhat, you know, just sort of starting out. But, you know, in the States, it's still like, who are you? So, you know, it sort of depends where you are, too.
And then, Tantia, for you, how about, you've been doing this for such a long period of time and you're deemed successful, you know, really amongst a huge group of people within your own community as well as the nation. So what does success mean to you?
Well, that varies from day to day. But today I'm thinking that success is, has been finding people of common vision, who, despite so many obstructions, when we were asked initially to come and bring an object or bring something that signified something about your career, I wanted to bring the Indian Act, because it is so debilitating, and like those boundaries on reservations, keeping everything in some kind of a container. And so for me to be able to go anywhere, coming from the world that needed a pass to leave the reservation, can you imagine? To be able to leave Montreal, you'd have to get a piece of paper from the government to allow you to get on the bus to go to Toronto or something like that.
Right.
I mean, it is just
it's insane world that we come from.
So it is like down to faith a little bit.
I think on the first one, I mean, it helps, you know, it's a bit of a family, so I think it helps, you know, that you've done stuff with them before, right. Like I'd had shorts there and whatnot, but it ultimately comes down to just, you know, it's a programmer's making a decision. Do they like the film or do they not? You're praying.
It's really important. It's really important, like, if you're asking that kind of specific question, like when you want to get into the business side, you have to understand the machines you're dealing with. And most of these industries are machines, and they have rules. And if you don't know the rules, you're never going to find your place. I think the first thing you need to do is be really honest with yourself and be really sincere and look how the machine works, for better or for worse. Because if you don't know how it works, you're used, like, you're, you know, it's like people, you put a record in the store, like, most people don't know that people buy the spots in a store. Like, it says number one, it doesn't mean anything. Like,
I didn't know that. I had no idea.
The whole record industry is like, it's a big ad. It's all bought space. So you have to realize that you can't be naive about these things. You have to really understand how the machine works, or have someone with you who really understands the machine. Because, you know, it's like the Grammys. Like, I watched the Grammys on Sunday. Like, does that mean that these are the best records of the year? Absolutely not. I can think like of like 400 bands I saw this year that are most likely better than almost every nominee that was there. You know,
right?
Like, so it's a machine. And like, if you want to go to the Grammys, that's like a very specific dream. So like, I want to go to the Grammys. So how do I go to the Grammys? And getting into the Grammys is a very specific way. You have to deal with specific types of radio stations. You have to deal with a specific type of part of the industry. Yes, and then I could probably go win a Grammy. But like, you can't be naive about these dream jobs, you know, like they're very specific types of machines for different types of dreams, and you have to really be a mechanic and know how they work, and you can't be naive about it.
Right. So Tentu, can you speak to that a little bit? How, especially because you serve as a mentor right now to many different young people as well. Did you have a mentor when you were going out there? And if you didn't, how do you mentor people today? How do you tell them, how do you get them engaged to pursue their dreams if it's in acting?
I shudder to think that I'm a mentor in a sense that when I started out, I would not go anywhere near theater school. I would not go to any of the institutions. I just had a lot of rage in how my people were perceived. And that's the reason I do what I do, is because I come from where I come from. And I refused to be disengaged. I needed to be talking and telling stories. And I remember the thought that I had, I'm going to tell on them, because there is so much misrepresentation in our history, that it starts with a prayer and being in the right place at the right time. So a part of the prayer is listening to that intuitive and deciding to go this way instead of going this way, and deciding to open up and have a conversation with somebody you don't even know. And it's a part of this place where you belong despite what structures are, because the structures were not designed for me, a Native woman in movie business. Especially, you know, like 43 years ago. And it's always been the people who love the arts, people who love stories, people who want to do something different, who invite you into that place. Mm-hmm. Because the world that I come from didn't have any of those structures. My ladder is a tree. And if you're lucky enough to have the right limbs on there, you can get to some distance. So that basically it's the people, the right time and the right place, and believing that you are where you are for a good purpose.
So speaking of that then, in terms of the right time and the right place, what does that even mean in this day and age where, for example, it doesn't necessarily, or does it matter where you're from? For example, you've got Justin Bieber who just kind of shows up on YouTube from Stratford. How much does place... Pardon?
It's such a lie. I mean, the kid toured for two...
For a long time, yeah.
You know, to make what we know of Justin Bieber is everybody's like, oh, he did a YouTube video clip and became famous. And the kid toured as like a teenager every day to like 200 radio stations around the country. Like, I don't even want to do that. When I was like 25, I do 100 days on the road and I wanted to kill myself, you know.
Right.
The kid did like some like 200 shows. Like, I actually think his mother's inhumane to make him do that.
Right.
No, honestly, it's not even a joke. I find it like child abuse. Like, touring is really difficult. I'm not, you're laughing, but like, I find it, like, I would think that should be illegal. I don't think a kid under 18 should be touring every radio station before he even knows. Like, touring is a very difficult thing. So anyways, I just wanted to cancel that myth because it's not true. Like, this YouTube video, it's like a... No, but it's interesting. It's not like a lot of people think these like magical wands that things happen. And I think it's a bit of an illusion because that's how the music business is made and film business is made. These stars just appear and everything's lucky. And it's kind of a lie in a way that it's important that it looks like that because that's why you go see a concert, because you want a dream to be in this position and you want to live in this dream and music's a dream. After like seeing what I've seen, yes, it exists in certain ways, and it's luck and crazy, amazing things happen, and bad things happen.
Oh no, I personally am not a big believer in luck. Actually, I do actually believe that your own luck. Oh no, there's certainly luck. There's certainly lucky breaks. I don't doubt that, but I do think that there's way more work than luck. But I wonder then too, in terms of place, whether it is YouTube or not, how many of you here have had to move in order to maintain a career in Canada? How many of you have had to go to the States in order to find some level of success? Can you just raise your hands? Like, I'm just curious. Has anybody had to go?
Not necessarily to the States, but moving all the time.
Moving all the time. But have you had to move at all, Jack? Or have you felt the need to leave Canada at all?
Well, you got to understand, I used to run a real estate company, and we just operated in the States as well as in Canada. And to us, it was just a different city. Like, we developed in Los Angeles, we developed in Kansas City and Dallas. Houston, New York. To us, it was just another city. It might as well have been Canada.
Right. So then how about the notion then of these sort of creative arts hubs? Because, you know, you had Paris for writers in the 20s. You have Berlin for artists, avant-garde artists right now. You have Los Angeles if you want to be in film. So then, Jack, what kind of creative hubs are in Canada, would you say?
Well, I think the main creative hubs, as I understand it, are... Well, you can't say that. I'm sorry, I take it back, because you have probably the outstanding short story English writer in the world living in Clinton, Ontario, which is a small little rural town. She does what she does because she's terrific at it. She's outstanding. She's acknowledged. She just received a major achievement award from the Man Booker Association. So I don't think there are probably hubs for different types of artistic work. I guess in Canada, Montreal, Toronto, and Vancouver stand out. But I think the other folks here are closer to that situation than I am.
Right. Tantu, could you speak to that at all? Creative hubs in Canada?
Creative hubs in my world, definitely Vancouver is a creative hub. Winnipeg is a creative hub. I'm talking in terms of Indigenous filmmakers. And we have some really nice filmmaking incubations going on in Winnipeg. And in the States, there's actually quite a few filmmakers that are making some headway. And I haven't seen a lot of what's going on in Toronto yet, but I've been hitting some of the Indigenous film festivals. And I think that the overall Canadian culture is going to be treated to some really fine filmmaking at some point. You know, it's kind of starting to break through, so it's pretty exciting.
And how about you, Deb, because you've worked both in L.A. and here in Canada, and your film actually took place here in Quebec. Maybe you could speak to us a little bit about why you chose to film it. You brought Zach Braff over from L.A. Why did you choose to shoot your film here?
I wrote it for the city. I mean, I love Montreal, and actually I think it's one of the most beautiful cities for shooting in Canada. So I knew that I wanted to shoot it here. And then, cinema, like film, I think in Canada is quite different when you talk about English language Canada and Quebec, because Quebec has a very different filmmaking industry here. And a lot of the films that, the kind of film that I was trying to make, and a lot of the filmmakers that are here, like Denis Villeneuve and stuff, were much more the sort of thing I was trying to do. So that was sort of why Quebec for me.
Right. And do you see Quebec and Montreal in particular as a creative hub? Was there a reason that you brought the film here for that?
Yeah, definitely. I think Montreal is always going to be a creative hub. Just I think the energy of the city, and you know, it's such a good city for artists. But it's a little different, you know. Once you start to get into working actually in the business, like I love the city, and I'm, you know, I loved making the film here. But could I continue working here and just make a bread and butter paycheck, you know, directing TV or whatnot? No. It's, you know, it's a very tight industry. It's very Quebecois, and I'm a total Anglophone. You know, so it's just not going to happen.
How about in English-speaking Canada? Do you think you could have a full career here as a director?
I probably could. I mean, I think, you know, going. I went to the. So obviously back and forth with the States, and that's a choice. You don't have to. I have a lot of friends who are just Canadian, but I think it depends what kind of career you want to make. Like, you know, for the typical, I think if you're a narrative feature director, is you're doing a film once every 3 years or so if you're lucky. It's a long process of trying to get the money for it here. It takes forever, and then you don't really make any money. So that's kind of your passion project, and you know, trying to do that. But to live on a daily basis, it's much tougher, you know. So obviously, Los Angeles, just for filmmaking in general, is the nexus. So there's a lot more opportunity just to make money.
Right. So Patrick, I wanted to ask you too, because you're so impassioned. Is it, you know, we're told quite often here in Canada that we don't have a star system. And essentially, you know, really, they do have one in California.
So I could answer the same question, though, because I have a good story about
that. Oh, sure. No, feel free. Yeah, if you'd like to. Well, feel free to continue.
It's just because my whole career started by that actual question. Like, because, I mean, I was finishing music school, and I was like, I had a big dream. I was like, oh, I'm going to make this big music thing. And so I decided to save up my money at that point, and I left work one day in the middle of my shift and said, I'm going to New York. So I had $80. I got like a total. I got in the bus, and I'm like, it had to be the late night, kind of like the weird bus with just like chicken coops above your head.
I've taken that weird bus. I took that weird bus to New York, too.
And I got about as far as the border, and I got on the border, and the border guy's like, what are you doing here? And I'm like, that's a really damn good question. What am I really going to do? I knew nobody in New York, and all I knew was that New York was this big dream place, you know, when I was just a kid. So I was like, I'm going to New York to be a musician. Well, what do you do, you know? And then I'm like, what the hell am I doing? So I didn't have the courage to get back on the bus at the border. So I walked from the border all the way back to Montreal. And I got like three quarters away, and this girl picked me up, which is totally weird. I don't know why girls pick up a guy hitchhiking. She's terribly annoyed. She's like, ah, what's happened to you? I was like, I'm such a failure in life. Like, I just feel like the biggest loser. I was too chicken to go to New York. And now I'm going back to school of music, where like school of music, blah, 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 blah. But the joke is that this is the actual starting point of my career. So I go back the next day, I meet the girl who had made the book of images. And then my first day of school, I sat in the steps and I was like, oh, I'm such a loser, I'm back in music school. And there's this guy across the stairs, looks exactly like me. I'm like, hey, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I can't believe I'm going back to music school. Like, and we decided to go to music class and stuff, and we ended up being in the same ensemble class. And there's another guy, like this in a sense, he's playing bass. I'm like, oh, that's funny. What are you doing? He's like, oh, I can't believe I'm in music school. And we turned out to be in the ensemble class, so we just have to play music together for a year, which turns out to be my band that I now play with for the last, like, 12 years.
That's amazing.
And the other thing is, I think if I would have went to New York, I don't think I would have ever been able to make anything as interesting.
Really?
Because I don't think in a big city like that, it's not what it used to be. It's too expensive. You don't have any time to build something interesting. You're already put in such a specific formula from the get-go. I think if you're building something, you should build it far away from these places, because these places will not let you build what you want to build. I think once you've built it, then you bring it outside, but you don't go near those places to build your ideas. They're going to destroy them. There's no chance you're going to be, you can't even afford to even have an idea there. It'd be too expensive.
You really think so?
Yeah, I do think so.
Well, I have to disagree with you there.
I mean, all the bands that in the last like 10 years, they moved to New York, yes, after they made a voice, or like none of these bands like are like very rarely are born and raised or people who found their voice in New York City or LA in music. I mean, it's
right.
I mean, all the bands, let's say with integrity,
right?
And I mean that integrity is not a judgmental thing, but I mean it's something that makes something interesting and different. It doesn't mean it's good, it's better, but I'm just saying
right.
All to say is that I think, you know, places like Sweden, there's all sorts of small countries that are blowing, they're amazing for music. And then you go to New York to play actor. And then it's easier because I didn't have to compete with a trillion people who already live there trying to do your job. You're like, you're an outsider, and it's easy.
Right.
Oh, you're from Montreal. You know, like.
So then I wonder then, Deb, I mean, could you speak to that? Because I think it's quite different when you're in music because Canada is so celebrated. Like Montreal musicians, we were talking about Arcade Fire earlier today. You know, if you come from Montreal and you're a musician, you're automatically lauded. Everybody loves you. You've got all this integrity. What happens if you're, well, to some degree, so what happens if you're a filmmaker and you're a Canadian filmmaker? I mean, do you have the same cred when you go out there? You're like, I'm a Canadian filmmaker. Do people turn heads when you're in LA?
From my experience, the answer is the exact opposite. We don't have much credibility. Pretty much, if you asked, I think most people in LA, they could maybe name Adam McGoyan and David Cronenberg, and that's about it. And I think the perception is generally that Canadian film is bad. So you're kind of fighting it a bit the entire time.
Right.
You know?
And then, what do you think of that in terms of literature, Jack? In terms...
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, I'm just wondering in terms of if there is a difference, do you feel that perhaps we have a system that really celebrates Canadian authors here? Do you think that it makes a difference if you move to the States or if you stay here in Canada? Do you think that...
I don't think it makes a difference where you're writing from. That's why I brought up
right.
the example of Alice Munro, who writes in Clinton. Mordecai Richter wrote in Montreal and in London.
Right. So it's just totally separate because your field is just very, very different.
Yeah, you just judge. Writers are judged by what they create.
Okay, great. And I guess another question that I have for you, Tantu. Oh, sure. Feel free.
I think that's a really good answer.
Yeah.
I think it's a really. I think it's the right way to look at it.
Right. So then, Tantu, for you, because you've worked in the States and you've worked here in Canada, do you feel that if you're a Canadian and you go to work in the States, I'm not sure where some of the films that you shot were actually filmed. Are you able to maintain a Canadian voice if you go down to the States and you work there? Do you believe that Canadians who are actresses and actors who move down to the States are able to do that? Or do they kind of become usurped and have an American voice when they move down there?
I am an Aboriginal voice. Even in the introduction, I'm an Aboriginal, right? So wherever I go, I'm Indigenous, and it's very hard to break through people's minds that I'm a human being, that I actually could play a doctor, I could play a lawyer, mm-hmm. I could play other human beings that are not necessarily clothed in hides and beads, or, you know, have to be explained if I'm an Indian character.
Right.
And I keep remembering when I was in Toronto, I had an agent in Toronto, and she was submitting me for a CBC story to play a wife. You know, that wasn't necessarily written as a native. But she got the word, no, it would be too political to cast me in that role because the husband was a cop who was molesting children. You know, what way is that too political? So, you know, I kind of fall into a different place. And in the States, I found it extremely hard to explain to an agent what I meant when I said not necessarily native roles. Oh, crossover. Okay, yeah, crossover. So what he would do, he'd submit me for Latino roles or Asian roles or, you know? No, that's not what I'm talking about. It was impossible.
Right.
So finally I said, no, I'll go somewhere else and see if I can find somebody who understands what I'm talking about.
Right.
So...
A friend of mine actually he's Maori, and he's been a working actor for a long time, but he is always cast in villainous roles. So how about in terms of men from your community who are actors, then? What kind of roles are they cast in?
Oh, are you Indian one or Indian two, they say to each other in the audition.
Wow. Boy.
Although men do much better. You know, as far as roles go, and it is changing. A lot of changes have happened in the course of my, you know, 40 plus years. And now you got some decent roles happening for women, and they're for younger women. So again, I'm in the same situation of breaking the wind, you know, of, okay, who's going to hire a woman of my age, and who's going to hire a Native woman of my age? And so it's just blessings on our filmmakers because they understand who a woman is and how important we are into the community. And so
you know, I'll be able to maybe work until my dying day, yeah. You know.
Have you done quite a few films where you've broken with stereotype?
I think, you know, I think that happens all the time. All the time. When I first started, I always remember this jubilation on the part of filmmakers because I could express an emotion. And every film I did, right up until Dances with Wolves, always someone, it got fewer as I went on in my career, but always someone would say, "Is that your first movie?" So, you know, what is it? The art of being an actor would be more acclaimed had it, you know, if it was not a Native woman playing in a Native character. It's like, okay, well, sure.
Right.
You know, that happens all the time, every day. Whereas if someone, you know, that's not Native is playing a character, oh my God, look at that acting, you know. And I had so many comments when, for example, I'm using Dances with Wolves as an example because you mentioned it. And it's like I grew up in that teepee, so, you know, mm-hmm. Yeah.
How about ambition with your communities? Have you seen people become a lot more ambitious of late or no?
What do you mean?
Within the youth culture, do you see, I guess the next area that I really want to move into is the notion of ambition.
The ambition is just palpable.
Right.
And it's so heartbreaking because it is horrifically difficult. When you think of another one of my down times, I had this dream, an actual dream, and I saw Meryl Streep's face going across this dark screen. And then I wake up and I think, okay, all right, okay, I'll get up and I'll do another day here. And then you look at it, Meryl Streep comes from about a third generation in this work, in this business. She comes from a stability where her family hasn't been torn apart, her community hasn't been torn apart, her mm-hmm. ideologies, her philosophies of life aren't tromped on and stomped on. And she's been allowed to continue to grow and progress. Whereas our kids, you know, some of our greatest artistic beings, you know, have to get rid of the snow on their blanket before they get up, you know, and to face the day. And
no, it's very true and very poignant. So Jack, I would wonder from your perspective too then, what is your notion of Canadian ambition? Quite often we talk about Canada as a nation, and I'm wondering if there is any such thing as a nation. Can a nation be ambitious? Are we an ambitious people? We quite often hear about ceilings in Canadian arts and creativity.
I don't think there's a difference between the Canadian and American idea of ambition as in terms of culture or arts. I think the only difference has to do with finance. I think the Canadian attitude to finance and the American attitude to finance and welfare is where the difference is. But from a point of view of culture, I don't think there's much difference. I think that, as far as I'm concerned, North America is one country from that point of view. And your talk about hubs, I think that there are hubs all over North America. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with tax credits. Mm-hmm. And that's what develops certain hubs, whether it's in the artistic community or in the technology community.
Right. So, Deb, are there any mechanisms that you know of that can push Canadian talent onto a global scale then?
I mean, for sure, there's the film festivals for film, which I think are huge in terms of, you know, getting an international audience and whatnot. You know, and it's sort of the same thing. I mean, I guess I think more and more a lot of Canadian films are starting to try to take advantage. Like, the same thing I was trying to do is get an American star or get a star, and that certainly gets a higher profile. So I think it's, you know, there is still stuff for film. We do have festivals and some outlets.
Right. So how about our Canadian star system? That was something we were going to talk about a little bit earlier. The idea that, you know, in the States, essentially what Hollywood has and what LA has is this sort of big illusion machine in essence. Is it a good thing or a bad thing that we don't have this illusion machine here? Or do you think we do have just a slightly less effective or loud one?
Well, I just think that we have, I think it's funny because we talk about success and things like about being really honest with yourselves. Like, I think we've built machines that I think try to replicate those machines, and I think they do a bad job, and I don't think it does any justice for us. And then we built other machines that were just like, okay, we can't do that, so let's do something completely different. And I think if anything, if you're going to be a country beside a huge country like that, I think that's kind of the better way of doing it. Like there's Junos and there's Grammys. Like, obviously, it's a Canadian version of an American idea, and I'm really against that way of thinking. It's the same thing in Quebec. Sometimes they make these. There's like Quebec. They talk about the French culture, and then they make a French version of a stupid American show. You know, like Jesus. You know, like you spent like all these years talking about having a French culture, and now you just made like The Voice, but in French. So now it's a French culture. You're like, no, it's a, and now it's a dumb French idea too. Now it's like it's. I just think that, like, then there's Polaris, but I think probably your idea with your book prize is probably a similar thing. So Polaris, they made an award that's completely different than all these other awards. So now I started traveling, and then all the different, like, you know, I'd be in Belgium, France, England, they'd all talk about this prize. They'd never talk about the Junos to me, even though we've been nominated, whatever.
So they talk about the Polaris prize?
Way more, because it was just different. It was, like, a different idea. It was a better way of, I think, a better way of finding which good music, because it was done by all the music critics around the country. I think it's a better approach instead of like an academy where it becomes like a closed loop system and gets really boring. So I think if anything, it's better like forget what the Americans have, even though yes, I kind of agree it's one country and we're not that different. But I think it's important that if you're gonna do something, just do it totally different. So you're not walking on anybody's toes and there's room for what you're doing. So I think I'd much rather see a Canadian ceremonies or whatever or grant systems that are completely different and
what about Quebec? Doesn't it sort of like stand out from the rest of Canada in having its own sort of creative arts system that's really highly celebrated, its own star system, etc.? What do you think Quebec is doing differently than the rest of Canada?
It's survival. I mean, it's a big question. It's a question of survival. I think we're very, very fortunate and very lucky that the language has survived. I think it's amazing, and I have my hats off for all the people over these like 30, 40, 50 years who have struggled to keep the French culture alive, because my music wouldn't even exist without the French culture. Like, for me, the city musically is for what I do, is a combination of, like, all my audience at first was French, because they liked kind of progressive music, they liked stuff weird. My first whole audience was all French, no English people. Much later, the English people came in my audience. So for me, like, the French way of doing things is kind of saved me and, like, in a way, I was very lucky.
Right.
So my hat's off to that. I think the only reason why it really exists, though, is survival. And we talk about creativity, too, and like, what inspires people. Like, for me, it's like, usually the great things are made from survival, you know, their ideas to survive with. You know, people who are sitting, like, if you want to, I'm going to try to give you an example, sorry, I'm blabbering. You're a kid who's, like, super bored in math class. You're like, you're sitting there and it's driving you nuts because you're not good at math, you hate being there, and you have to do something so you can survive in your head. So you sit with your pencil and your pen and you're like, you make something amazing just to entertain yourself, just so you don't go crazy.
Right.
And I think that's the roots of creativity, is survival.
Right.
And for me, like a lot of people talk about, and I'm going to show you why I'm talking about Quebec after, is that a lot of people think creative is like because you wear a flower on your shirt and you wear like put a sunflower in your hair and you get all like la di doo di da and it's I can't think of anything that's built like, you know, Lord of the Rings written in the trench of a war, you know, like so many amazing things that are made. You do it so you don't go nuts, and you do it because if you don't do that, you can't live here. And I think that's one of the most important seeds of creativity. I think Quebec, the reason why it's such an interesting place is it's a closed island. If it wasn't self-sufficient, you wouldn't be able to be an artist here. So out of survival, they made this incredible system that can make them self-sufficient. I sell more records here because I'm from Quebec than any other place in the world.
Right. So it's interesting
Canada
to
altogether.
Just because, yeah, like for you, place is so important. For Jack, it's a lot less important for the people that he works with. So Jack, I'm wondering...
Well, Mordecai Richler, like you talk about artists like that, is someone who captured the streets of Montreal at a very special time. Like, I think you could be anywhere and capture something special, but the place where you're writing and the place you're creating is still the part of the stories that you have to say. So I agree with them that I could be in the middle of the woods
right.
and have something interesting to say, but you can't take away the place from the story, you know?
Right. So then, Jack, what is the role for you then in terms of the differences between supporting the arts from a government perspective, from a corporate perspective, and as a personal patron? Because these are three very different ways that we're seeing these sorts of rungs being made available to people to sort of ascend in the creative arts.
Well, it's very strange. I grew up on Henry Julien and Pine Avenue, which at the corner there's the Fusilier du Montréal, the FMR, and that's where I first, as a kid, saw John Buchan, who was then the Governor General. He's the one who I think in the 50s started the Governor General's Literary Prize. And when Mordecai and I were starting, Mordecai hated the Governor General. He said that what right do they have to sort of deteriorate my book by signing it? I didn't ask for their signature. Well, where we came from, we decided that sort of we can do things ourselves. I think the government has played a significant role in a country like Canada in trying to help. But I think in the long run, it's up to individuals to sort of do things that they can do. That's why we started the Giller Prize. That's why other people have started everything else. Like RIM or BlackBerry started in a hub of Waterloo. You had a situation. So I think wherever there's a desire of people who are related to the arts in any way, shape, or form, there are many different people who are now involved in supporting the arts in many different ways across Canada. So I think it's really less a government responsibility than an individual responsibility today than ever before.
Are you seeing that there are groups, like I've noticed, for example, even in the environmental movement, there's people like Renewal Partners, there are people who are exceptionally wealthy who all get together to serve as these group patrons. Do you have that sort of community? Does that sort of exist in a way?
I think it exists all across Canada.
Right. And then I guess really lastly, I would really just like to ask each of you, if there is some sort of cultural formula for creativity or success, any final notes that any of you would like to add? Anything that you think that Canadians can do better or Canada can do better to elevate and support people in your respective fields? So, Patrick, if you have any thoughts on that?
It's hard. I think at this point when we talk about Canada, because I think it's probably a difficult moment for Canada to feel together. I don't know why. So I feel like the Canadian voice itself is a bit blurred, and I don't think that will last long. So I guess for me, my perspective is more Montreal. So I don't know what I changed in the city. I feel like our formula or whatever happened here worked very well, and I was very lucky to be here at that moment when it worked. But I think it was just a question of all the bands we would play, these weird concerts in lofts in the middle of the night. We had no rules. We had no law. There was no labels here. Like, there was no business people to help us. So we just built this crazy music, and then we started touring, and people were like, oh, that's cool, you know?
And then, Deb, would you say there's anything to the formula that you would add, tweak, add, subtract?
That would be sort of a huge thing with film, you know, because for Canadian film, it's primarily telefilm, and so there's a whole system. And definitely, you know, there's been a million points of view, and they've changed that so many times, and I don't have the answer to how to fix that. I think for me, and I think a lot of directors and filmmakers, and I know the most frustrating thing for film is that we make films and then nobody goes to see them in Canada, mm-hmm. So we have no audience. And that's one thing that Quebec is kind of amazing for, or that's why, is that because they actually do support their own. They go, they watch their own television shows, and that's why they have stars, and they, you know, do see their own movies. So I don't know what the answer is with that, but I think that everybody I know, a lot of the people, the reason they're ending up in LA is that they feel like, oh, I kill myself for 5 years to make an independent feature here. I make it, it's really, really hard, and then nobody sees it, and the distribution just dies.
Right.
So I think that's definitely, you know, for film. I don't know what the answer is, but I know what the problem is.
And then how about for you, Tentu? What would you say needs to change in terms of a cultural formula for success or creativity and change? If you could change anything, your dream wish list.
Well, of course, I would like people to really kind of understand what our roots is, what our contribution is, because there's a lot of
mythological ideas in people's minds about who we are, what our contribution can be, is, has been. For me, a major element of that is our relationship with the earth, being a living organism. Life, like we are, the earth is alive. And that's been so much of what's been driving me. So the importance of our stories is really, really urgent, I think. In that I would like to see organic theater in absolutely every community. And that means, because that's what was taken away when our ceremonies were outlawed, right, when our languages were outlawed, that the big idea is who we are in relation to civilization is really fuzzy and lost in a lot of cases. So, and the work that I've done with young people in theater telling their own stories, this is what really empowers them, when they're able to tell their own life stories, and that brings the fire. But then you have to have a place for them to continue, to be able to continue to tell their story. Otherwise, they hit this brick wall, and there's all this fire that goes into ashes there. And there's so much in our communities that needs to be understood for this civilization to be healthy. And we have enzymes, you know, as indigenous people, we have enzymes to make things stronger. And I'll leave it there, I can go on.
Oh, that's lovely. And then Jack, if you have, I was just wondering, what is your great wish? You've created this wonderful prize, you have elevated so many people in, you know, the Canadian literary world. What would your big wish be to enhance your area?
Well, I think I would start by saying that stories are really the important element in life. And stories are what really brings people together. And, you know, the old-fashioned way people used to tell stories around the campfire, now they're writing stories. My wish is that more people would read stories, whether they're by Canadian authors, American authors, French authors, makes no difference. I think that we should encourage reading across the entire spectrum of Canadian and American society.
Wonderful. So thank you very much, all of you. And now I'd like to really just open it up to anybody on the floor. If any of you guys have any questions for our guests, if you would like to move to the microphone on the right or the left, could I ask you to just move up to the front here? And if you have anyone in particular you'd like to address, feel free.
So who's going to go
first? You
go
first.
Okay. I'm a businessman, and I've met a lot of people here. I think I'm probably the only businessman here, apart from maybe Jack. And I just want to say that these last 2 days have been about the most exciting I've experienced for a long, long time. And I think whoever the organizers are of this event, I think maybe we have one right here, you know, I think the business community, a lot of people in the business community could be, you know, very, very interested in what's going on here, and I found it very, very exciting. I'd like to just address something to Jack, who I do know. Jack, I mean, you were a very successful businessman, and, you know, I've been reasonably successful in business myself, and I'm a great lover of the arts, but it didn't come right away. What was sort of the key moment that you sort of really got interested in writing or the arts or whatever?
Well, most people don't understand that I started off writing. I was a cub reporter for the British United Press, and I was earning $27.50 a week. And then I was offered $75 a week to write speeches for somebody. So things happen by themselves. I put myself through McGill writing for a magazine called Argosy. So writing has always been part of my life. And I guess when I married Doris, I got involved with a bunch of drunk journalists. So, so it just sort of transpired from there. I hope that answers your question.
Matt Zimbel, I think Patrick mentioned something that's kind of important, and that is that he talked about Montreal being a kind of a closed, or Quebec being a closed community, being a place because of the French language that has been able to develop a star system and has been able to thrive because of that. And I think if we look at English culture in Canada, what has happened is it's become so dominated by American culture that the star system has not been created. This is not news to any of us. But what we need to do is we need to have in English Canada our own Bill 101. We need to have a cultural policy that is so strong and that is so protective, especially in the internet age, which will allow our cultural industries to grow and prosper. And I think that without doing that soon, there will be not much left to really protect. It kind of goes against every vision I have for free enterprise, and I'm sure we're not going to let that businessman leave this building without getting him to commit to some kind of prize.
Mom,
or
him.
Get him now.
Yeah.
But it really has become critically important. If you look at La Presse, for example, La Presse has, every day, it has an art section of 5 to 6 pages. If you look at the Globe and Mail, you turn one page, and it's over. If Jack had not started that prize is huge. It's a big deal. Every year, it's a big deal.
So did you want to address this to one particular person on this panel? Is there some person who you think could particularly answer your question? Because
I don't have a question.
Oh, you don't have it? It's a comment.
I have a solution.
It's a solution.
The solution, I have a very quick solution. I won't dominate this conversation any longer. I think that for the film industry, we have huge problems, which Telefilm has tried over and over and over to address, and they've not been successful. I think what we need to do in this country for musicians, for artists, for writers, for everybody, is to reverse a policy which allows the television stations to broadcast simulcast, which allows them to play American programming at the same time that the Americans are playing that programming, so they can sell commercials to American shows. The moment that stops in this country, there's going to, by force of nature, there's going to be a huge influx of money. $650 million a year will not be spent in LA every year, and Canada will become more like Quebec because they will have to produce for indigenous, for our own culture. That's the solution to the
problem.
I can
say, definitely working in television, that there definitely is that movement occurring right now, just simply because our economy is quite different than the one in the States. And for the very first time, we're seeing, even at Discovery Channel, people coming from all over the world, from Australia, from Japan, even the United States is commissioning from Canada. And there's been a real reversal, and there definitely is a lot more television, like homegrown TV content for Canadian audiences that is being built here and that is being sold abroad for the first time. But we're starting to see that happen, so.
Just to answer to that thing, I mean, I am an English-speaking artist in a Bill 101 land, and I'm not a, you know, I personally don't attribute the survival of the language to Bill 101, personally. I think, in fact, my personal opinion on Bill 101 is it shows the exact opposite of the French spirit, in a way that why I think French culture exists and persists is because it's really fun and amazing, welcoming, exotic, colorful, and it's not because it puts rules. And I think that probably one of the most important parts, and like when we talk about French films, one of the reasons why, you know, we talk about Denis Villeneuve is because he made a really gutsy, amazing film. It's not because he's from Quebec. He made an incredible film that's really gutsy, that's really racy, and you know what I mean? It's nothing to do with these French. It's nothing to do with because of Bill 101. I don't know. Just to say that, I'm not a huge fan of the Bill 101. I don't think it brings the best out of the French people, and sometimes I think it brings the worst out of them. And I don't think it's the reason why French culture survives.
Hi there. Hello. My name is Cam, and I'd just like to say thanks for getting all these wonderful people together to talk to us over the past day and a half. It's been really a special experience for me. And I just had kind of a general question. We've been talking a lot about failure and picking up the pieces and moving along and moving forward. And Patrick, you made a comment or alluded to making your own luck and kind of moving forward that way. And as a general question to everybody up on this stage there and anybody else who'd like to comment, what are your thoughts on cultivating ingenuity as a personal trait and taking calculated risks in life?
You're saying, if I understand the question correctly, like how much, what do you think it's the worth of being like somebody like makes a quick solution to problems? And is that what you mean? Or what do you mean exactly?
Not necessarily a quick solution, but maybe making a creative solution or the best solution with what they have.
I mean, that's what success. I mean, that's the only key to success, I think.
I mean, I think actually that's one advantage of the Canadian system in terms of film, from where I'm coming from, that for my film, I never could have done it in the States because of the commercial pressures on that. So one of the things you can do here is take risks and actually do what someone like Denis Villeneuve is doing. And it's sort of like, why not? You know, if we don't have the financial pressure to make the box office, we should be doing it.
Yeah, it should be crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you talking about, like, doing stories that are completely out of the mold that... financiers can feel more confident that they're going to get their money back, taking that risk?
Not really so much that way. I'm talking more in a personal sense, as in we've talked about, well, sorry, we haven't. I haven't said anything up until now. But, you know, somebody made the comment that they had a plan in mind and sometimes it went the way they wanted it to and other times it didn't. And what I mean is kind of how to go about things when the plan fails and that kind of thing. And in a personal sense, what's a calculated risk is in weighing all the options that you as a person have, and is this a good idea to take this risk, and what are the possible repercussions if it doesn't go well for me?
We were just, if I could speak to that just for a second, just because we were having this conversation. My friend Jonathan is here too, and he was the editor on Deb's film, actually. And we were talking about the notion of just rigidity and resilience, right? Because sometimes, and in fact all the time, one has to expect failure. And ultimately, we all have to expect loss, right? I will eventually lose my job. I will eventually lose my life. I will eventually lose my mind. I'm bound to lose something at some point soon. So, you know, we all have to embrace that. We all have to know that really, I mean, it's entropy that's on the way, right? You know, you're going to fail. And how are you going to adapt to that? Because there's going to be certain times when it happens a little bit earlier. So you have to, and that's where that game of numbers comes into play. And the reason why, for me personally, selling encyclopedias door-to-door taught me a lot, because I knew that 500 people were going to say no. I knew it already, and I knew that somewhere somebody was going to open the door eventually. So I was willing to take the risk because I knew that eventually, just in the law of numbers, something would happen. But when things don't work out, then you sometimes just have to realize, okay, I have to shift my plan. And I think the people who don't succeed are the people who will rigidly stick to their own idea and will not embrace any flux, and you can't survive in that way.
I think failing's kind of relaxing.
I think it's kind of helpful to, you know, to have the philosophy that when things don't work out the way that you planned it, then obviously that's meant to work out some other kind of way. Gifts from the gods, that and friction is a part of creativity and all that good stuff.
I find it kind of failing really relaxing, because you know something now that was a bad idea, and you're like, I don't have to think about that idea anymore. That didn't work. Now I can think about the other thing.
Yeah. But I think it takes a long time to embrace failure too, right? Like sometimes it's a hard thing that you sit with for a long time, because, you know, you have this dream, and I think this is the real thing with everybody who's here on this panel today is, you know, they've had such big dreams, and that's the risk that you have to take. And one thing we haven't really talked about today is really sacrifice, right? Mm. Because if you're going to do this, you have to suck it up. Like you were talking about with Justin Bieber, like he didn't just miraculously appear, he sucked it up. He's been touring for a long, long time. So
touring,
there's risk and a lot of sacrifice. Yeah, touring. You're just like,
yeah, it's,
you're
it's
not
a good point.
Liking
it's
this
a, it's
touring.
A very good point. No, because it's very interesting, because people, and I think everybody here probably talk about the sacrifices, but like it's true that we don't really talk much about sacrifices. There's a lot of heavy costs, I think, probably to all of our dreams. Well, maybe, I don't know, I won't speak for everybody, but I know that touring looks really funny from far away, but when you're in the band for 700 hours a year, not so funny.
Yeah, not so funny. So I hope that answers. And then, yep, sounds great. So just two more with you guys who are here. And
we have 1 minute. kisi ginamasi ledet nige gisko kwelali. So as I said, I wanted to thank Tantu Cardinal for being here and for sharing your story. I am from Listigut. I'm Mi'kmaq, and I wanted to ask a question in terms of your structures, that you said that you had shied away from the structures as you were developing in your career. And it reminds me of the document, Redefining Our Success, that was made possible by the Canadian Council on Learning. And so based on that, they have a model as well that's based on the tree. And my question is, what do you see, or what recommendations or modifications do you see that are needed within these institutions to allow those stories to be heard?
Well, I'm not one of those people that runs these things, but I think it's really important for people who do to recognize that there's a wealth of vision that can be brought forward that we're missing out on, and that would be very healthy for us to know more about, to really have an openness, not a predestined idea, okay, I'm going to let this in because I know that this exists here, but to really open up to the flow of what's available in our communities.
Yeah, and what the document says is that education nowadays, well, prior to education for Aboriginal people at that time was an if and, and today it's changing to yes, you know, we need that in to become more empowered, you know, for our nations. So I'm just curious, like for me, I'm standing here based on the decisions that my parents have made and my grandparents have made, or, you know, whether it was yes decision or no decision. For instance, for enfranchisement, you know, my grandfather, who was a veteran, decided, no, I am not leaving the community. And so I'm standing here today with the gift of being able to speak my language based on that decision. And so I guess as my generation, what I am hopeful, or what I hope to do, is to kind of elevate, you know, that those opportunities for my children. And that's, so that was my question.
Gapwe. And I also am fortunate to be able to speak my language, but that's because my grandmother couldn't speak English well enough. So she spoke to me in Cree, but would not allow me to speak Cree back to her. So that's my story. And the great good fortune of being able to have that language is just enormous. Just one quick example is that the Cree word for fire is iskoteo. And it's made up of two words. The word for woman, isko, and mete, heart. Fire is woman's heart in the language that was outlawed and forced underground. So when Trudeau came in, I recognized that the Canadian content ruling was really important for me to be able to even know that I could be an actor. Because in that was, you must tell Canadian stories. And knowing that in order to strengthen a country, you have to put money, you have to strengthen culture, you have to strengthen language, all of these things. But yet in the same moment was the white paper to outlaw our cultures, to get rid of our treaty status, to get rid of our strength. What is that? You know, that really has to be understood. And that's what Idle No More is about. It's not some fluffy thing. It's ground floor. It's about the table water on many levels.
Well, thank you.
We have time just for one super, super quick question.
Thank you very much. I don't know how I'll follow that. But I guess this question is mostly about the film industry, inspired by Deborah, but anybody can chime in. So you were talking about how difficult it is to get people to come out and see Canadian films and Canadian content. Is there like the common solution is to ship up actors from the States to sell. Can you foresee a situation in which like the Canadian aspect will be attractive in and of itself? Or will it just really be a matter of making content that is marketable? And is there a marketing structure in place for Canadian films that compares to American films, I guess, all of that?
it's been going on for years. They've been trying to figure this out. So it's a really tough question, you know, and obviously nobody's really solved it properly. I'd say, I think already, you know, bringing American stars, certainly what I did it, and I know that the year that I was at TIFF, you know, premiering the film, there was an American star in almost every one of those Canadian movies that was there for first features. So it's already happening, and it's just, I mean, it's part and parcel of the fact that getting the financing and distribution, it's just, it is so difficult, and it's all contingent on the actor, particularly in the U.S., that, you know, they're literally, you know, it's who's bankable. So you cannot make the film half the time if you don't have an actor. So that's sort of I feel like that star system is already happening. And I think, you know, a lot of Canadians are trying to bring back Canadians that have already gone there. Like, if we could get Rachel McAdams and Ryan Gosling, we would be. that's already on the way. In terms of getting the audience, like the actual Canadian audience, to go and watch the films, I honestly have no idea how that happens, because I think they've tried so many things, and it just doesn't seem to work. We're right next to the U.S., so we're getting all that culture coming up. And all of our, you know, in terms of building a star system, we're losing them all. I mean, Jim Carrey, they're all gone. They go to the States. So I don't know how you get Canadians to watch. And in terms of, it's also not quite as clear as Quebec, obviously, because, you could do an entire another panel on just what is a Canadian film and what's Canadian identity in general. So I don't even know that Canadians even know what they're supposed to be relating to when they're watching Canadian films. Like, I watch them, and I'm not sure why that's Canadian, you know, sometimes. So honestly, I have no idea. I think it's just trying to make a really good movie, and hopefully on some level that will surpass, you know?
I think one thing, too, is just because my sister actually works in the entertainment industry. She works for ETalk. And, you know, we're aware of how many Canadian celebrities, like if you think about it right now, Ryan Gosling, Rachel McAdams, Justin Bieber. In fact, we export so many top stars. And what we need for them to do now is actually pay attention to Canadian media and not turn their backs, because really that's what ends up happening. You become a really famous celebrity, and half the people at the Grammy, I mean, there's a lot of Canadian stars, and we need to raise our Canadian stars so that they pay attention to Canadian media and don't turn their backs on Canadian media once they make it.
Can that be incentivized, or has it already been incentivized to its full extent?
I don't think it's even been discussed.
Well, the problem is trying to convince Ryan Gosling why it's a good idea to do a $2 million independent Canadian movie is not very easy, given what he's getting, you know, or what he's being offered.
So
and you can't really blame him, you know, because if he's getting a chance to work with Scorsese, what are you going to say, you know? Like,
But anyway, thank you all so much for joining us today.